Valerie June from Undercovers, an album of covered tunes, Fade Into You, the old Mazzy Star tune, Buddy Guy featuring Kim Wilson, Kiss Me Quick from Born to Play Guitar. Lindy Ortega gave us Liberty, and it was Michael Franti and Spearhead. Life reminds us we're alive. It's Undercurrents. Greg here, taking you way, 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 way back early into the career of Neil Young in just a minute.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
It's time to pack your bags and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a summer of memories with KBOO and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give. to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Now, before we get to today's show, just a reminder that our Camp KBOO Summer Membership Drive is going on now through June 29th. KBOO is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio, and I'm one of the volunteers for the last 40 years, which is made possible by people like you, our listeners, and together we can keep the station alive and thriving. It's been 56 years so far and counting, but we need your support to continue delivering quality independent programming. Help us reach our $50,000 fundraising goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give. That's on the internet at kboo.fm/give. And we thank you for your support. Today, we're going to talk about the challenges that women face. And they face a multitude that often incite shame and overwhelming cultural pressure to stay silent. All these passages, you know, there's girlhood, body image, motherhood, reproductive choice, sexual trauma, menopause, and more can create stigma that shrouds so many women's experiences. Today's guest asserts that liberation can follow when women are empowered to get vulnerable and talk about the hard stuff, which can create cultural change that acknowledges and supports women's truths. Our guest today is Dr. Jessica Zucker, author of the new book, Normalize It, Upending the Silent Stigma and Shame That Shape Women's Lives. Jessica is an LA-based psychologist specializing in reproductive health. She is the author of the award-winning book, I Had a Miscarriage, A Memoir, A Movement. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Washington Post, New York Magazine, Vogue, Harvard Business Review, among others. She's been featured on NPR, CNN, The Today Show, and Good Morning America, and earned advanced degrees from New York University and Harvard University. Well, hello, Jessica, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, your career is dedicated to women's reproductive and maternal mental health, and you've been writing for many years about pregnancy loss and life after. And you created the hashtag Had a Miscarriage campaign and wrote your first book on the topic. And it's fascinating. You write, in the weeks after my miscarriage, a friend inquired how I was doing, and I asked if she wanted to see photos of the daughter I'd recently lost. She said she did, but upon seeing them, she recoiled, a look of horror and fear on her face, and you were blindsided by her reaction. Tell us about that and how that stimulated you towards your book and the movement.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I'm a Los Angeles-based psychologist, and I specialize in women's reproductive and maternal mental health, and I've done so for about 15 years at this point. And I come to the field of psychology with a background in public health. And my vision when I earned my PhD was to marry my interests in my clinical practice. I was dedicated to all things women, women's mental health. Up until that point, I had not lived through anything specific that informed my career trajectory until I did. So I was 16 weeks into my second pregnancy when I had a miscarriage while I was home by myself. I was prompted by my doctor by phone to cut the umbilical cord and then began to hemorrhage. My husband, all the while, was darting through Los Angeles traffic trying to get home to me. And we went directly to my doctor's office with the fetus in a bag to be tested. And to make matters all the more traumatic, I then underwent an unmedicated DNC. So all of that to say that I had been sitting across from women and families for years, hearing about the pain, the anguish, the alienation, the isolation in the aftermath of pregnancy and infant loss. But until I went through it myself, I didn't understand fully. So I turned to the research, and the research shows that a majority of women are blaming themselves, feeling a sense of shame, guilt, and even body hatred in the aftermath of pregnancy and infant loss. And with that information, and now sitting in my own grief, I decided I had to do something about it. I'm not one necessarily to get on a soapbox. So I didn't really sort of sit down and make a plan about creating some viral hashtag or movement or campaign, but that is exactly what resulted from my first New York Times piece, which came out on October 15th, 2014. October 15th is Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Day. And basically, this piece was an invitation for women around the globe to ask themselves if they had gone through something related to pregnancy loss and they had not been open about it, or even if they had been, what feelings were they hiding? What feelings were they keeping to themselves? What feelings were they still having? What feelings did culture tell them to be quiet about? So essentially, I created the I Had a Miscarriage movement with the aim of replacing cultural silence with storytelling.
Okay. All right. And you write that the act of openly discussing experiences that cultural norms deem unfit for public consumption can be metamorphic, as you put it. Why is there such a stigma around something that is not all that uncommon?
I mean, that's the most important question of all the questions, right? When it comes to women and girls' experiences, it seems that so many of the milestones are shrouded in silence, stigma, and shame. And I sort of see this as a swirling trifecta, that the silence begets the stigma, then begets the shame. And so we're not just quiet about pregnancy loss, even though miscarriage occurs in one in four pregnancies. We're quiet even about menstruation, which is most likely happening to every girl and woman through their lifetime, right? As well as later in life when people go through menopause. This is not something that culture talks about out loud, prepares us for. There's such a lack of education and open dialogue around the myriad changes that women's bodies go through, that their identities go through. And so it does create a sense of shame because we are not necessarily prepared and we're not having discussions out in the open.
Do you think a lot of this goes back to ancient superstitions about blood or whatever? I mean, I wonder whether patriarchy was the beginning of all of the stigma and shame around menstruation, or whether it preceded that. Of course, we have no definitive way to know, but I'm just curious what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I think patriarchy has so much to do with all the topics we're talking about. Why are women made to feel badly about themselves from the jump? And I think a lot of that has to do with the sort of power and control that maybe they don't feel that they have, or that wasn't granted to them. And it's a real, disservice to our world and our culture that girls from the beginning are starting to question what they know, what they don't know, who they are their bodies acceptable, is bleeding somehow quote unquote bad or aberrant. And all of these things are normative, and yet people are suffering in silence. I mean, it even applies to things like postpartum depression, right? So everyone seems to be expected to be a mother at some point or another. There's so much cultural pressure around that, as you know. And yet, 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 women are experiencing perinatal and postpartum mood and anxiety disorders. What about them?
Right.
What about the structures that are not in place that support people in this new experience?
Patriarchy is such a all-pervasive influence ever since it started. It's fairly recent, and it's only about 6,000 years old. Before that, the hunter-gatherers, they don't think, I don't know, I read Sex at Dawn, and I found it very enlightening. It's like they don't, monogamy and monotheism were kind of invented at the same time. And before that, people probably didn't care who the father was. There was no concept of paternity. I mean, I think women were held in much higher esteem in the old days, because some of the old graves show that. So the biggest grave was the high priestess, that kind of thing. But I think marriage might be the worst thing that ever happened to women.
I mean, that's an interesting point. Say more. Tell me all about it.
Well, it's sort of like, what is marriage? It's like traditionally it's a property agreement between men, and after we left the hunter-gatherer realm where nobody had any private property became a new invention. Okay, we got to have the grain to get us through the winter, and we need to protect our grain and make weapons. And what else do we need to protect? Oh, we need to protect the women, and we need to protect the children. And then all of this kind of patriarchal possessiveness and ownership. And oh my God, it's just kind of what a incredible cultural metamorphosis that was. So that's the way I see it. But I mean, we can't go back to that. But it's like, it's just amazing to me how people choose these patterns. I don't know how we unchoose it. But anyway.
That's an interesting point. How do we unchoose? Or if we can't unchoose, as you say, then maybe we kind of get messy in the details and figure out where we are in history and how to redo or undo or change some of these patterns as we move forward.
Right.
So that girls and women feel like their stories matter, like their pain matters, like their joy matters, and that they can say it out loud without feeling like they have to be in hushed tones, and without ultimately blaming themselves for something they had no hand in.
It's admittedly very confusing. I think it's extra confusing based on reading your book and other things that I've read to be a woman. It's like there was a book that I read. I never interviewed her. I'd love to. It's called The Female Brain. And she talks about, this is a psychologist and a psychotherapist. She talks about all these passages that girls go through, and all these hormonal adjustments that are just radical. And men have nothing like that. The male experience is pretty steady state. We just need high testosterone all the time. And you know, we don't have that kind of stuff. And I think it just scares people. It's just inherently confusing. And it's really good that people like you are writing books to help bring some clarity to this.
Thank you so much. I mean, yeah, I just figure that we need to replace the antiquated societal silence with something. And I believe it's storytelling. And as I show in my new book, Normalize It, there's so much research that tells us that storytelling connects us, it can affect and change the brain. And when we are going through hard stuff and good stuff, we want to be in community and we want to commune with other people who get it. And so this book is sort of a call to action for people to put it out there, dare themselves to question why they might be holding so much shame or blaming themselves, and maybe take some steps, maybe put a toe in the water to see if they can release some of these feelings that maybe don't serve them.
Now, you make a very strong case about the importance of storytelling and how storytelling helps. It's kind of the solution to a lot of this stigma and shame, is being open and being vulnerable and sharing one story. That can be a very healing process, but a person has to be discerning about who they share with, right? I mean, there's trauma, there's this thing called trauma dumping or oversharing. How do you help women? I mean, of course, a therapist is the best place, but you're going beyond that in your book. I mean, you're not just selling therapy in the book. So how does a woman know who to share with or who not to share with? Because people say things like, well, at least you have another child, or at least you're able to have another, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, yes. They say all of the platitudes and put their feet in their mouth. And, you know, these are well-meaning loved ones oftentimes. And so I try to give those people grace, knowing that they are not trying to be offensive. They truly are saying what they think might be helpful. But ultimately, what ends up happening oftentimes, especially surrounding grief, people are saying things to stave off the grief. People are trying to put it into a container and help the griever somehow focus on a silver lining. And as you say, you know, a lot of these sentences start with at least you know you can get pregnant, at least you're young, at least you have a healthy child, at least you have a thriving career. These things actually send grievers running for the hills and make us feel alienated, isolated, and make us then have to wonder and scratch our heads, should I have shared with this person to begin with? I mean, it's a hard question what you ask about how do we know? I mean, how do we discern, you know, who's a safe person? And sometimes we can't know until we try. But as I argue in the book, we are sharing to primarily put our stories in the world for ourselves first and foremost. So it is a bummer and a huge disappointment sometimes, and even heartbreaking, if a loved one says something that, you know, can be alienating or is just so off base.
But it's well intentioned.
Well, and the thing is, if we're close enough with that person, perhaps maybe in that moment or weeks later, we wrap around and we say something about it so that we can repair that situation. So we just can't know who will get it and who won't. Maybe if we know somebody who's lived through something similar, that raises the likelihood that they might say something more empathic and loving. But it could just be a neighbor that we see, you know, every day as we're walking the dog, who we don't know their life story, and we tell them something about ourselves and they get it. Right. So we can't necessarily know. And, you know, the point though is to move it through our bodies and to reassure ourselves that what we've lived through deserves to be acknowledged. And so whether that acknowledgement comes through writing it in a journal so that we are even just putting it somewhere, or telling a friend, a loved one, or even hopping on a TED Talk stage.
Right. Right.
And sharing with the world publicly. There's just so many different ways that we can explore what we've been through.
It's kind of nice to have a safe space. I mean, outside of the therapist's office, you know, like maybe a group. I belong to a men's group, and we all subscribe to confidentiality, and it's a safe place to share things that you might not want to share publicly. You know, I have a great title for your next book.
Oh, let me have it.
The Art of Grieving. I think
I'll take it. Is that not already a book? It should be.
It might be. I don't know.
It's great.
I haven't looked, but I mean, I think it's what we need to learn the most. You know, we're all getting older. We're all going to die. We're going to, you know, aging happens. Life is full of loss. The older we get, the more loss we have to confront. You know, we need to learn how to deal with difficult changes, including loss. And I don't think we're very darn good at it. We run away from it. That's why people,
that's right,
on the street, you know, people are going to give you these platitudes, or they don't want to hear it. They don't want to feel it. They don't want to,
that's true.
You know, they don't want to deal with their own grief. So, you know,
that's right. I can't believe you're tasking me with writing a third book. Oh my goodness.
Well, it's all, it requires consent on your part.
Oh my goodness. I don't know. I don't know if I have it in me, but you know, I couldn't agree with you more. Society needs to embrace grief because it is not going anywhere. So the sooner we start talking about these things and we lean into it, the sooner we get to sort of emerge as different people as a result of our grief. You know, if people are so afraid of it, they stave it off. That's what creates depression. That's what creates anxiety. That's what creates anger and the rest of it. So I think learning to sit in it, to be present with our feelings, can do wonders.
Yeah, it's so hard to get people to do that. That's good therapy that'll do that. You know, I want to ask, you know, in a society that expects and pressures women to prioritize family, which is traditionally a husband and biological children, parenthood is the assumed default. This is out of your book, the only normal path for a woman to choose. I'm wondering, do you see this changing fast? You know, as somebody who's currently single, I see the dating universe is completely different than it was 20 years ago.
Interesting. Okay, well, you can tell me more about that because I'm not living on that side right now. But yes, I mean, I think among patients and among younger women, it seems that there is a huge shift in questioning whether or not they want to become mothers instead of feeling like they have to do it because it's assumed. I think, you know, finances are an issue. I think people want to be able to sort of explore their careers and travel the world and not necessarily take on the responsibility of child rearing. And they've also seen probably tons of divorce through the course of their short lives. And, you know, they see they might be questioning whether or not this is something that would actually enhance their lives. Now, this doesn't mean necessarily that they don't like kids. Choosing not to have kids does not mean you don't like kids altogether. It
but
just means for some people that they don't want them.
Is there actually biological pressure? There's certainly cultural pressure. There's certainly social pressure. There's psychological pressure for women to have children. They get FOMO, or you know, and they're, you know, the biological clock. You hear about that. But I'm wondering, you know, is there a lot of biological pressure for a woman to have children? Sometimes I wonder, why is a woman having why are they so compelled toward motherhood?
Well, I mean, I think it's all the things you listed before. I mean, it's all the pressures. It's familial pressure as well. I mean, it could be religious pressure too. I mean, I think if we grow up hearing, oh, you're going to be the best mommy, or here's a doll, take care of it. Like, you're, look at you, you're already such a great mother to your, you know, stuffed animals. I mean, I think it starts so young. And so it, you're right. It could be hard to know how to discern between a real want and the swarming pressure that's existed for decades.
You know, I had an interesting conversation with a friend, a female friend, who's 60, and she never had children. And I told her, I said, you know, son, I think a lot of people have kids for very selfish reasons. And she goes, oh, I think just the opposite. I think it's selfish not to have kids. And I go, oh, well, you must feel bad. You must feel bad about yourself. But it's like, okay, you know,
right.
I think people can have kids for very altruistic reasons. They can have a calling. It's a vocation. Parenting is a really hard, long-term commitment.
It sure is.
But so anyway.
I was of the mindset that, I mean, thinking back to my sort of later 20s, I was of the mindset I was open to having kids if I met the person that I wanted to do that with. I don't think I felt like I'm going to do this no matter what, or I'm going to sort of settle for someone that I'm not that into, but I want to have kids so badly, I'm just going to make this happen. So that was me. But I do think that a lot of people are not necessarily conscious of why they're doing it or not doing it. Well, they're more conscious of not doing it because they're choosing that path amongst a world that's mostly having children.
Yes.
You know,
that's
but I
default.
Think there's so many factors. Exactly.
Right,
exactly.
Right. Well, you know, we've only got a minute left. This really went by super fast. It's like, you know, what do you... There's so much in your book about, you know, how to grieve and how storytelling helps us derive meaning from our grieving experience, and how we can normalize being good enough instead of striving to be perfect like a Virgo. And you write, you know, where vulnerability thrives, shame can't survive. Give us, you know, you've got a minute. Give us your last words of wisdom for today.
Well, you know, I guess what I want to say is I know that there are bumper stickers these days. I love that mental health is sort of in the zeitgeist and being talked about. And there are, you know, signs and stickers and t-shirts that say you're not alone. And I think that's fabulous. I think it's really important. It means that hopefully people are talking more openly about what they're living through. My main message, though, is, you know, there it's one thing to hear you're not alone. It's another thing completely to actually feel like you're not alone.
Right.
And I think the feeling like you're not alone comes through braving that path of vulnerability,
right,
of opening up, whether it's in the context of a therapy office or with a friend, a loved one, in a support group, even, you know, in a journal, however.
I would have to say, thank you so much. You know, it's like we have run out of time, and I the people that get to have you as a therapist are so lucky, but the rest of us have to settle for reading your book. And
thank you, there's
so much information there. It's beautiful. And I want to tell our listeners about your website, which is www.drjessicazucker.com. That's just all one word, drjessicazucker.com. Now, for those who may have tuned into Pathways late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien. Now, don't worry, you can play or share this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Dr. Jessica Zucker, author of Normalize It, Upending the Silence, Stigma, and Shame That Shape Women's Lives. Very profound book, I highly recommend. I want to say a heartfelt thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways. which is broadcast on KBOO.FM in Portland, Oregon. Or perhaps you subscribe to the podcast version for free, which you can find at divination.com. That's D-I-V-I-Nation.com, as well as on Pathways Radio. If you look it up on Paulo's YouTube channel, where if you like our conversations, you can give us a thumbs up and subscribe. And please feel free to forward a link to your friends. And don't forget about our Camp KBOO Summer Membership Drive. KBOO is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you, and we need your support. Just go to kboo.fm/give. On the internet, www.kboo.fm/give. A staple in our community for over 56 years, KBOO is a meeting place for revolutionaries and creatives alike. Show your support by becoming a sustaining member at kboo.fm/give. And thank you for that. Well, this is Paulo bidding you adieu and reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Podcasts. And thanks again to Jessica Zucker and to all you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
Hey there, KBOO listeners. This is Dr. Tony Zimbardo.